Welcome, everybody. This is the third office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, the Economics of Obamacare. And we've got a few people in here live. And fortunately, they got the ball rolling by asking some questions. So Vitor says, good morning. Are the office hours an inherent part of any Mises Academy course? I don't think so. I just do it, I always do it unless I'm traveling or something that I'll miss that week. But I don't know whether other professors do it or not. I'm pretty sure that most of them do not do it. For some reason, I think maybe David Gordon does, but I'm not sure about that. But to answer your question, no, that's just something that I do, because typically nobody's using the Mises WebEx account on Saturday, so I don't think it's costing them any extra money. And I know some people sign up for my classes just because they like to ask me stuff on the Saturday session, which sort of baffles me, but there's no accounting for preferences. Okay, Brad asks, so the participation has been declining since 2000 and accelerating during this recovery, in quotation marks. How much of that do you contribute, I think you mean attribute, to Obamacare? And with the Dow up about 24% this year, how do you see these first 2 years of implementation impacting the U.S. economy? Okay, so in case people don't know what he's talking about, I think Brad's talking about the labor participation rate. Correct me, Brad, if I'm misunderstanding your question. So just a little bit of a background on that for people who aren't sure what he means. When they do the official unemployment numbers, what that means, and let me also just even spend just a few moments explaining the rationale of it, because it's with a lot of this stuff that they do, like with the BLS correcting the inflation, the price inflation numbers and stuff like that, with all this stuff, it's not even that the individual analyst who's on the government payroll cranking these numbers out and making these adjustments is consciously aware that he's working for Darth Vader or something. You know what I mean? It's these things could be sensible, and if some academic were to do it on a blog post and say, hey, you know, if we adjust the numbers for this factor, look at this, it's not even like that I think the guy would be a jerk or something. Right? It's just that when you're working for the government and the people in charge have a certain vested interest in putting out a particular line, a particular worldview or description of what's going on, then they can draw on the economists, and since you can do whatever the heck you want with economics, you know, you start making it empirical and adjusting for things and interpreting historical episodes the way that most economists practice it, they can get any number they want. So, with the labor participation stuff, here's the idea. So, you don't want to, as a general rule, when you say, hey, what's unemployment like? You know, is unemployment really high or low, or what's the situation? Really, what you mean, you don't mean how many human beings in the economy do not currently have a job. All right, because there's infants, and there's elderly people in the hospital, and there's things like that, right? There's college students who don't want to be working. There's 8-year-olds that don't want to be working. Okay, so you realize, okay, it's when we talk about unemployment, what do we mean? Really, what we mean are the people who want to be working and yet can't find a job, and even that is a little bit. If we were really going to get anal about it, we had to get more specific. For example, right now, I would love to be the starting guard for the New York Knicks. Actually, I'd rather be for the Boston Celtics because of my background. But either way, you know, I'm not going to be picky about the team. There's no way they're going to hire me to be the starting guard. And I could even say, and I would love to even do it for their salary. In fact, I would do it for 10% less than they pay their current starting guard. So does that mean that I'm involuntarily unemployed and that there's a failure of the labor market here? Well, of course not, because I'm actually not interchangeable with the current people in that position from the point of view of the employer. The people running those MBA teams do not consider me to be an equivalent worker to their current starting guard, right? So you, I'm just pointing that out, because a lot of times when just real quickly economists define what they mean by involuntary unemployment, they might say something like there are workers who are willing to work at current market rates, wage rates, and yet no one hires them for the position. And so I'm pointing out that, well, no, that actually isn't enough, because of the example I just gave, that according to that definition, I'm involuntarily unemployed because the MBA teams won't hire me. So that's not exactly what it means. But my point is, clearly, in general, when you say, oh my gosh, during the Great Depression, unemployment went way up, we have in some mind something very specific, and it's not just how many total human beings don't have a job. So what that means then is you get into weird situations where nowadays in this crisis, what has happened is when you have prolonged unemployment, when workers lose their jobs and they're trying to find work and they can't, after a while, they just stop looking. And so the way the government keeps track of those numbers, you know, they'll send out surveys or whatever, or for people when they're applying for unemployment benefits, or however it works. In various ways, the government gets the information by which they report the monthly jobs picture and unemployment statistics. It makes a difference whether, from the government's point of view, you are still actively seeking work or whether you're not. And so if you're no longer seeking work, you aren't counted as unemployed. Just like, you know, some guy wins the lottery, he quits his job, and then he's just living on the beach because he won the lottery. He's not unemployed. You know, you wouldn't want him to be counted in the unemployment rate, because that would be misleading. Okay, so it's a perverse thing where, you know, just following that technique or that approach to calculating the numbers, if you have a situation like we've had since 2008, where there are people who really are, you know, they're not on the beach living off the lottery, they're trying to find work, and then they just get discouraged and give up, or they just, you know, start taking part-time jobs or something, and they stop applying to full-time jobs, even though in their mind, you know, this is not a good situation. They're not happy with their current employment position. It's just they're taking odd jobs here and there because they know getting a 9-to-5 job at an office or working in the factory again or whatever, or, you know, building houses or whatever they were doing in 2007, they have just given up on that. And they say, the economy's awful right now. I got to do something else in the meantime. Okay, so the point is that the standard way that they report unemployment numbers can drastically understate how bad the labor market really is. So I partly went through all that just to show you it's not a pure Darth Vader, haha, let's screw with the numbers, that there's a rationale for why if somebody drops out of the labor force, if somebody is no longer actively seeking work, you'd say, well, then they're not unemployed, right? But in this situation, that kind of approach leads to absurdities. So what some people are doing is looking at, you can look at various measures like, okay, well, how many total jobs are there? In particular, the one I like to look at is how many total private sector jobs are there? And I haven't looked at the number recently, but like as of, I don't know, 6 months ago, I don't think that was even higher than the 2000 peak. Okay, so not even adjusting for population size and stuff like that, but just how many total employment positions are there? Maybe it's full-time. I don't know what the exact qualification of the statistic was, but and it was probably like non-farm or something. But like how many non-farm payroll positions in the private sector are in the U.S. economy? And I believe that number still is not as high as it was 13 years ago, which is kind of incredible when you think about it. because even during the Bush recovery after the dot-com crash, people were calling it a jobless recovery. So I'm kind of covering a bunch of stuff here, but I might as well just make sure you guys have this background. The way it's done in the United States, well, around the world in advanced Western-type countries, when economists talk about recessions and recoveries, typically what they mean is GDP growth. So they would say that, oh, when did the recovery start after the dot-com crash? And they would typically look at how GDP growth has been changing. Like if it was falling during the crash, that's a recession. Then it bottoms out and then it starts rising again. Oh, that's a recovery. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the employment situation follows it in lockstep. And that's actually what happened is GDP started growing just fine, but job creation, to use that popular phrase, lagged way behind. That it was GDP kept growing even though there weren't more jobs being added on net, or there weren't very many jobs being added on net. Okay, and then the same thing now, that according to the official GDP calculation, GDP stopped its fall and started growing again in the third quarter of 2009. But clearly, the average person in the United States feels like the economy has still been awful since then. It's not like, oh yeah, it was really bad up until the summer of 2009 and then things started getting better. That's not the way it feels to most people, at least in sort of blue collar and lower middle class affairs. Okay, so Brad is asking me then, I'll click on the chart. So he sent a thing called the labor force participation rate. And this gives an idea of what percentage of the civilian labor force. So the labor force, I believe, is defined as people 16 and older. And so if it's civilian, that means if you're in the military, they're not counting you in this statistic. So they're saying of the potential people who are eligible to be working, so they're not talking about little kids, like 16 or older, I think is where they cut it off. That's a civilian labor force, non-military. What percentage of that group of people is in the labor force? And that number kept rising. So it was like around 59% in the 1950s. And then during the 60s and especially the 70s and 80s, it just was steadily rising. And it peaked in the late 90s at around 67%. And then since then, it's been falling pretty substantially. And so part of the explanation of why did it rise up was that women entered the workforce and drove in the 60s and 70s. Okay, so before women, it's not like women were working in the 1940s. They were just working in the home. But as more and more women began to enter the formal workplace and get paid wages or salaries, that drove it up. But for some reason, that peaked in the late 90s and then has been plummeting ever since. So Brad's asking me, what's going on? But why is that the case? And yeah, Brad, I think it's a lot of things. I think part of it is simply that as the situation changes and employment prospects change for certain groups, it no longer really does make sense for both people to be working. That, if there's one major breadwinner in the family and then there's someone staying home with the kids, by the time you figure in the cost of childcare and the taxes and everything you pay on that second income, unless the stay-at-home spouse, and typically you would say the stay-at-home mom, but actually, I know more and more people, even in my own social network, where the wife can earn a higher salary, and so the husband stays home with the kids. It just on the margin, it doesn't make any sense. In other words, instead of having your kids grow up with a nanny or whatever, and then go off to school somewhere, it's just more and more people are deciding, you know, one of us should just stay home and homeschool our kid, and then, you know, the kids can be with the parent instead of with strangers, and, you know, then we don't have to pay the taxes on the extra salary and so forth. So I think that's a big thing. But then Brad's asking, is Obamacare contributing to it? It's hard. I mean, before I gave a real specific answer of that, I would probably want to look more at the data, look at the exact timing of things and the announcements and so forth. For me, what I would want to do to really, and I may even, I'll see if I can do this. Let me write a note to myself. I'll see if I can do this before the next lecture. To me, a better, a more specific test of the impact of Obamacare would be to see, do we see a sharp change in the proportion of part-time to full-time employment, right? Because among the things that Obamacare does, not only does it make just hiring in general more expensive, but specifically it makes hiring full-time workers more expensive. And so one thing you would expect is that in the presence of Obamacare, relative to what the counterfactual would have been, which we technically don't know, what is the percentage, you know, so of the new jobs created, for example, is the percentage of part-time positions versus full-time, has that changed drastically? Because under Obamacare, part-time workers are not, do not kick in the employer mandate or do not trigger the employer mandate. So Brad, like I said, I'm sort of dodging your question. Yeah, the timeline in general fits that as Obamacare passed, you see labor force participation dropping. But for me personally, to be confident that it was Obamacare in particular contributing to that, I would look for the thing I just said. And I will see if I can dig that up. Okay, Brad, oops. So I'm skipping questions. Oh, then Brad had also said the Dow's up 24%. How do you see the first 2 years of? I mean, it's dangerous when Austrian economists start talking about stuff like this, because we know full well knowledge of economic theory is not sufficient for you to make general pronouncements about the economy. But there is some very strong evidence, I think, to show that the Federal Reserve is really driving the stock market. You can see a very clear correlation between movements in the, I typically use the S&P 500, not the Dow, but they probably look similar, and the Fed's balance sheet, for example. And that shouldn't be surprising. And even defenders of QE should be willing to agree with that, because they should say, yeah, exactly. Right now, the only thing keeping our economy afloat are these rounds of QE. So in their mind, it's not that Bernanke's just blown up a stock bubble, but in their mind, it's that, no, we really need QE. And so every time he injects it, the economy gets some relief, and then investors rationally push up stock prices, thinking the economy now is going to be better off than before the announcement. All right. So whether you think QE is good or bad, I think you would have to agree that right now the stock market is being driven by QE. So from an Austrian, well, certainly from a Misesi and Rothbardian perspective, that's not a good thing to acknowledge that it's monetary inflation that has pushed the stock market way up. And another thing too, Brad, I think, and you're probably getting at this in your question, is it's not like on paper there's any reason to be optimistic about the U.S. economy, that the government keeps doing stupider and stupider things. And so as bad as you thought the situation was, let's say back in 2009, now you should be even more terrified with all the stuff they're doing. Well, it depends, I guess, because when Obama first came in, people were saying he was going to do the next New Deal. And so it's possible that actually what he's gotten away with since then is less than what some people may have feared. So I guess I should be a little bit more careful with what I'm saying. But certainly in the absolute scheme of things, not relative to what you might have forecasted, the stuff the federal government has done in the last few years has been horrible. And in this class, just all the stuff we're talking about with Obamacare, I mean, I got more pessimistic just teaching you guys this stuff and just seeing exactly what these provisions are. So there's no reason fundamentally in my mind that the stock market should be booming as it has been. And you certainly don't see that in the labor market or anything like that. So in that respect, yeah, I think that we are seeing an unsustainable boom in the Austrian sense of that term. Okay, Vitor says, to what extent are Wall Street companies part of crony capitalism, and to what extent are they part of the free market, roughly speaking? I don't claim to have studied the exact breakdown, Vitor, so I don't know exactly how to answer it. Certainly, a lot of what's going on, there are certainly many Wall Street firms who are totally crony capitalist. Okay, now, does that mean all of Wall Street is? And the other thing, too, is I think it's partly just a function of the opportunities they had, right? So it's, had it not been for the housing bubble and collapse and then all the problems with the mortgage-backed securities and derivatives, the other derivatives, blah, 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 it's not like Wall Street on its own could have just gotten all the sorts of handouts and special favoritism that they've been getting from the Fed and from the federal government the last few years. So if we had a laissez-faire system, then the people in the financial sector would be doing their jobs and the profit and loss mechanism would steer them and the types of products they offer and services would prima facie be a good thing, just like a restaurant in a free market. If it's been around for a few years, you would think, okay, it must be doing a good job. Otherwise, it would have gone out of business, right? So, that doesn't require that the people running those firms are passionate fans of anarcho-capitalism. They don't even need to understand economics. They just have to be embedded in a framework of the rule of law, property rights, and so forth, and then market forces lead them to do the right thing. And if they're in charge of really big firms, it's because they must be good at satisfying their customers, whether or not they philosophically or economically understand the system in which they excel. So by the same token, then, when the situation changes, the environment changes, and now all of a sudden all these firms are in danger and some of them start running to the government for help, I don't know whether you blame the companies or whether you blame the government for being willing to do that or what. I mean, it's partly just, I'm also mad at the public for going along with that. On the other hand, I mean, they really did oppose TARP in ridiculous proportions, and the people in Congress and whatever just rolled over them and let it happen. So I'm sort of dodging your question because it's hard to explain exactly how all this came together. It's not as if any one group on its own could do it. It took a combination of events. And unfortunately, I partly just because of who I am and my role in all this, I'm disappointed in the free market community that we obviously did not do a good enough job in the decades before this happened. Not that I've been around for decades, but in the movement, but you get what I'm saying. Just, it sort of shocked me that the moment there was serious danger and people got afraid, how quickly they threw out their platitudes about the market and just rushed to the government and headlined the government, the Fed, to fix everything. And I don't mean, you know, it doesn't surprise me Paul Krugman did that. I'm talking about so-called right-wingers, you know, people that call themselves conservatives and, you know, complain about government budget deficits and the kind of stuff that happened in 2008. If some South American country had done that, these guys would have been calling them fascists. They probably would have called for sanctions or something on them because they don't understand the benefits of laissez-faire capitalism. But they were loudly calling for the Bush administration to do the same kind of stuff. So that to me was really disheartening, was to see just how easily people, when they got scared, would throw all of their alleged principles and run to the government, the Federal Reserve, that was going to fix things. So, I mean, if you're saying, I guess, Peter, if what you're asking is right now, do I think that Goldman Sachs and those kind of companies are basically free market outcomes that are providing valuable services, or do I think they're basically creations of the state? It's hard for me to answer because I think there would be companies like that in a free market. They would be offering different products probably, and they certainly wouldn't be as large a share of the economy as they are right now. But certainly the current ones have their current position because of their willingness to jockey. So in other words, you know, the reason Goldman Sachs is still there, but Lehman is not, is just because I think historically the fact that Paulson was the Treasury Secretary during the Bush administration when that happened. And so Goldman Sachs had done a better job of making sure their people were inside looking out for them. So in terms of understanding the current companies right now, why are they on top? I would say, yeah, it's because of crony capitalism. So if that's what you're looking for, then yeah, I would say that. But in a free market, laissez-faire environment, it's possible that Goldman Sachs would still be there and the shareholders would have pick a different board and a different CEO just reading the environment. You get what I'm saying? So. Okay. Dieter asks, is there a book that employs a Crusoe isolation approach to the origins of money that you know of? Like little by little introducing other members and see how money emerges. Well, Vita, I think I do that in my lessons for the young economists. That, you know, starting with just a few people, start explaining what a medium of exchange is and how that works, and then just expanding it. I guess I don't go right from medium of exchange to money. I guess that stuff is kind of done quickly. But in terms of going from direct exchange to a medium of exchange, that's done almost painstakingly slowly. Like some people even complained and said I spent too much time on it. So I would say maybe look at that. I haven't read, but there's the Schiff book about how an economy grows or something like that. It's possible in there they do something like what you're talking about, but I haven't read that. Okay. And by the way, for not just Peter, but anybody who's listening to this, my lessons for the young economist, the PDF is free online. So just Google Robert Murphy lessons for the young economist PDF and you should be able to get it. You don't have to buy it. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So Brad is saying that, yeah, Schiff's book does it in story form. And so the title is How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes. Okay, so Brad now is asking, so if GDP is used to define a recovery, isn't government spending a part of GDP? So if we double the money printing and government spending doubles, then don't we have a healthy recovery? If that's true, why do we nearly have universal acceptance of the GDP as a significant means of measurement? Yeah, that everything you just said is totally true, Brad. And that's what's so funny about what happened with the Obama stimulus. And then on the flip side, what happened with the sequester. So let me just take a few minutes on this stuff. So in terms of the theory and how it works, yes. GDP is defined as final goods and services produced in a certain time period. And for various reasons, it's easier for them to measure it by looking at spending. That's one way to account, like the data is better, you know, they have access to that more frequently and that kind of stuff. Okay, so in principle, there's nothing crazy about that. Because, yeah, you might say, well, wait a minute, but spending money is not productive. What we're trying to isolate is what was actually produced. That's the important thing. Who cares about spending? And you're right, except where they're coming from. And this is what I mean, how an academic economist could put forward these views and not be sinister about it, which is the way they end up being used by the government. So if somebody produces a car, and that's what we're trying to really measure is the production of the car, like that's the productive thing, is to assemble and yield this vehicle now. That's the good thing that we're trying to measure. And then someone comes along and pays $10,000 for it. And then somebody else produces a television set, and that's also a productive thing, but we want to be able to compare and say, well, how much do these things weigh in the statistics, right? Is it better, is it evidence of more production to produce the car versus a TV? And you can't know that by looking at the physical components of it, because they're different things. They have different inputs into them. So the way you measure it is you say, well, how much are people willing to spend on it? And so if somebody spends $10,000 on a car, but somebody else spends $100 on a TV, you say, okay, so the car was 100 times as productive, as much production as the TV. And that's how you would weight them in the GDP. So that's the sense in which why looking at expenditures is a decent measuring rod if you're trying to quantify and you're having to add apples and oranges or cars and television sets to get a single number. Okay, so the problem now is that Brad just brought up, well, a lot of what is purchased in the economy is purchased by the government. So it kind of makes sense to say if one consumer is willing to spend $10,000 on a car and somebody else is willing to spend $100 on the TV, it sort of makes sense to count the car as being 100 times as valuable because everybody has money and has access to the different goods. And so the fact that a car can sell for $10,000 when a TV is selling for $100 is, loosely speaking, kind of an indication that the car is more valuable. And again, this stuff gets all, you can't compare individual subjective valuations. That's nonsense. But I'm just trying to say, given that you want to have some mechanism or some procedure to come up with a number to try to figure out is the economy cranking out more stuff this year than last year, adding up the amount that consumers and businesses spend on stuff, you know, that's not crazy. Okay, you can see why somebody would do that. But that logic sort of breaks down when you look at the government buying stuff, because the government doesn't have the same incentive to be careful with how it spends its money. Because with consumers, they're not going to spend $10,000 on a car if they hate it, because they could do so much else with that $10,000. But that's not true for government officials. For people, for Congress people, a congressman trying to steer and get defense budget dollars spent in his district, that's the benefit to him, right? It's not like he's going to say, oh, I don't want to spend more than $200,000 for this helicopter because otherwise we'd be wasting money. No, it's good for him, for his political career. If they spend $300,000 on the helicopter that really the contractor can build for $200,000, because now the contractor's really going to be glad he got on that contract and then contribute to his election, re-election campaign and blah, blah, blah. Give him a nice consulting position maybe when he retires from Congress. So that's partly why it's not as, you know, even putting aside the morality of it and everything, you know, there's certain principled Rothbardian type objections to government expenditures, but even just on a purely economic sense, the rationale for counting expenditures as going into GDP when it comes to private consumption and investment expenditures and net exports, which is foreigners buy stuff made in the United States, that rationale is much weaker when it comes to government expenditures. And so then you, as Brad was highlighting, you get in this weird situation where if there's a recession and the government comes along and just spends a bunch of money, that prima facie contributes to the recovery when recovery is gauged at GDP growth. Even if the government just paid a bunch of workers to dig ditches and paid other workers to fill them back up, paying for that, you know, hiring some contractors, then who else goes out and hires the workers, that expenditure per se, you know, for the line item ditch digging counts as part of GDP. And like, oh, in addition to all the cars we made last year, look at all the ditch digging services we got. And how do we measure the relative magnitude of these ditch digging services that were produced? Well, we look and see how much did the customer spend on them, right? So even if the government spent $100,000 to get one guy to dig a big hole and give another guy $100,000 to fill it back up, it took them 2 hours total, that would count as $200,000 of GDP. All right, so there is that aspect. So what's funny, Brett, is given how much the deck is stacked, nonetheless, GDP growth after the Obama stimulus was much lower compared to what people thought. And on the other side, when they did the sequester, it should be the other way around, right? Because the sequester, they had actual cuts. I mean, I think they were relatively modest, but they really did cut U.S. federal government spending slightly. And then certainly relative to trend, but even in the short term, they really did slightly reduce the absolute level of the government's spending. And so that prima facie would lower GDP just right off the bat. But, and so people were forecasting all these horrible GDP numbers. And in fact, the economy's growing faster than they predicted, than the Keynesians predicted it would grow in the absence of the sequester. So it's the flip side of the Obama stimulus, where the economy was worse with the stimulus than they predicted it would be without the stimulus. And so that just goes to show you how bad government spending is. That even with the deck stacked in its favor methodologically, the way they compute those numbers, so in other words, the government spending $1 billion by itself should raise GDP by $1 billion. So if in fact GDP fell, that means that it wasn't just a wash. It wasn't just that $1 billion in the private sector didn't occur. It's that the private sector output fell by more than $1 billion because of what the government did. And that just underscores how ridiculously inefficient it is the government does something. And there's various reasons for it. For one thing, for the government to get $1 billion, if it taxes people $1 billion to get $1 billion to then go spend it, well, depending on the way it raises the tax revenue, there's various estimates, but that might destroy anywhere from $1.2 to $1.4 billion in potential output that otherwise would have occurred because taxes are distortionary, right? If they raise the revenue by slightly raising income tax rates, Well, now on the margin, people have a lower incentive to work. So it's not just the transfer of the funds from the private sector to government. It's that now the tax base shrinks. The people don't want to work as much because the incentives of how much they get to keep after tax has gone down. So there's things like that. Okay, Vitor says, why do you think that China keeps buying all of these dollars and indirect? Let me just say one. And then, so Brad's saying, well, then why do they use GDP as a measure? Well, why does it go? I mean, because a lot of people are working at government funded institutions or working for the government. So, of course, they're going to keep using it. And then also because a lot of people don't have the same visceral negative reaction to government spending as a lot of Rothbardians do. And that they would say, well, no, but I mean, if the government builds a road, that's definitely a useful thing. Or, you know, if the government contributes to green energy products, that might be good. Blah, 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 you know, so they would think to exclude it would be to miss out on a huge fraction of the economy. And so that, you know, they might say, put in an adjustment for that factor that I mentioned, but they certainly would not say that $1 billion of government spending should be completely absent from the GDP calculation. They might at best say, well, yeah, you might want to put in a factor, so maybe it should only count as, you know, $850 million instead of $1 billion or something like that. In fact, Brad DeLong did that once when he was doing some back of the envelope calculations for how great more deficit spending would be right now. He said something like that, and I'm making a number up, but it was something in that ballpark, I think, where he said, so if the government spends $1 billion extra dollars right now, runs, you know, has the deficit be $1 billion higher, what are the impacts? And he said, well, there's the direct impact on more output. And he said, like, call it $850 million, because in the way he put it was, the government is all thumbs, you know, all thumbs. So that's for foreign listeners, that's an expression to mean somebody's real awkward, right? You can imagine someone trying to do something if instead of fingers, he just had thumbs. And that was the way that Brad DeLong summarized the fact that government spending is less productive than private sector spending. He said, oh, well, it's all thumbs. I mean, which is a radically different perspective from Murray Rothbard, who looks at the state as an organized criminal gang. In DeLong's view, it's this big benevolent giant that lumbers along and wants to help everybody and free the world from dictators. And unfortunately, I'm all thumbs, so let's reduce my efficacy by 15% or whatever number he picked. I don't remember. Okay. Okay. Beater says, why do you think that China keeps buying all of these dollars and indirectly helping Americans keep their purchasing power? Does it expect that the U.S. will really pay them over, or even expect the U.S. government to take private property from ordinary citizens to pay them with it? Well, for one thing, it's not obvious to me exactly what the Chinese government is doing. That if you look at, depending on which statistics you look at, it looks like they are slowing their purchases. And then I've even seen things saying it gets really tricky. What's it called? There's like the Federal Reserve has custodial accounts or something like that, where they're managing holdings of treasuries and other agency debt, like mortgage-backed securities that are guaranteed by Fannie and Freddie, stuff like that, where foreign entities are the nominal owners, but the Federal Reserve is the one managing them. And so I have seen people allege, and I didn't get into the numbers, so I don't know if it's true, but I've seen people allege that through some hanky-panky with the accounting, the Chinese government is actually surreptitiously reducing its holdings of U.S. dollar-denominated assets, or at least issued by the federal government or guaranteed by the federal government, without trying to make it look like that to the casual observer. Like, they figured out a way to kind of move stuff around in different accounts, so in the official statistics, it wouldn't look like they were sharply reducing their holdings, even though they may have been. Okay, so I don't know. Like I said, I didn't spend a day looking at those numbers and totally researching it, but I have seen things like that, and it gets really hard, you know, when people talk about what does China own? Well, when they say China, do they mean the Chinese government and central bank, or do they mean any entity at all that happens to be located in China? You know, so there's stuff like that too. So it's tricky. To answer your question, though, I think they have painted themselves into a corner where they and other foreign holders are very nervous about what the Federal Reserve is doing. They realize the federal government's only, or the Federal Reserve's only play at this point is just keep creating more money, and that every time the economy seems to falter, the Fed's reaction is just to promise more money creation. So these foreign groups that are sitting on hundreds of billions or even more than $1 trillion worth of dollar-denominated assets have to be very concerned about that. But when you're that big of a holder, you got to be careful. You can't just decide to reduce your holdings by 30%, because if you did and it was public, that would cause a panic. And then there'd be a crash, and then your holdings would plummet already. So I think they're in a situation where they're trying to transition and get away from being so dependent on the dollar without making a big announcement and saying, hey, everybody, we no longer trust the dollar, because that would blow up in their face. Okay, and like I said, in having that theory, you can see stuff that the Chinese officials have been doing and announcing. Like just last month, there were some remarks by various Chinese officials that seemed to say, assuming the translation is accurate, that yeah, we're moving away from the dollar and whatever. Like this was like a governor of a province or something, and some other kind of mid-level bureaucrat talking like that. So, you know, it could be the translation was off. It could be they didn't have the authority to say that, or it could be that that was real. I don't know. Okay, George Smith says, you pointed out that administration economists knew Obamacare would fail, but serve as a precursor of single-payer health care, if not fully socialized medicine. Why would Obama want to attach his name to a program that was destined to fail? Or was he deluded by his advisors into believing it would work? Oh, okay, that's a good question. Because, George, I don't think – well, a couple things. So, right, first of all, I don't know. It's not like I was privy to these backroom meetings. Right? So this is all speculation. I don't want to give off a sense that I really know what's going on. But my guess is that a combination of what you're saying, that Obama is – he's a very smart guy, has surrounded himself with smart guys, and it would not surprise me in the least if he vastly overrated what they could do with a bunch of money and guns at their disposal, being as smart as they were, and his understanding of how the world works. So there's that. And also, even if there is, well, I don't know where the term Obamacare came from, to be honest with you. Because if you remember, when under the Clinton administration, when they took steps in this direction, the way the critics destroyed it was to label it Hillary Care. And that made it sound nutty. And so I actually don't know. That'd be interesting to find out who was the first person to call it Obamacare. It wouldn't surprise me if it was Fox News that wanted it to be called Obamacare, to label it as it's this guy's thing. Like Social Security is not called FDR Security, or Medicare is not. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know that his advisor said to him, hey, let's personally attach your name to it. And the other thing, too, is let's say it plays out the way I fear that it might, that this current hodgepodge doesn't work, and so then they move to a single payer, and then ultimately fully socialized medicine. It's not that I think the history books would record Barack Obama tried something and it failed miserably, and he was disgraced and had a lot of people die unnecessarily until someone came along and did something better. That's not the way it would go down. It would go down in the standard history books as the free market in healthcare clearly doesn't work. Americans saw more and more with their own eyes how much it didn't work. Barack Obama tried to bring in single payer or whatever, and there were various forces in his administration that saw the light, but with the hostile Republican administration, in fact, many Americans still reticent to respect the first black president, he had to compromise and get what he could, and then later the system was patched up, blah, 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 to get to where we are today in the wonderful, you know, 2100 with fully socialized medicine. You get what I'm saying? Like, that's the way it would be depicted in history books. So, regardless of how savvy he is, if what he wants is to be considered a great president, he's doing the right thing. Right? Because it's not going to be repealed, I don't think. I hope it is. I hope to be pleasantly surprised. But now that it's in there, I think Paul Krugman is right. Now that millions of people are getting health insurance who weren't before, assuming they can sign up on the website, I don't see how they're going to repeal it, because then there's going to be a million people plus who are direct beneficiaries of it and who are going to be willing to march and do all kinds of stuff to keep it in force. Nathan says along these same lines, do you think mainstream Republicans will run on a let's repeal Obamacare platform? They might, but they're a bunch of, I mean, they had a huge mandate in the, when was that? In the 2010 elections, right? When Obama said, wow, I got a shellacking. There was a huge mandate for the Republicans to come in. What did they do? I mean, I don't know the exact political back and forth, and, you know, maybe if I was there with them, I was John Boehner's right-hand man, I would realize he did everything humanly in his power, but I don't think so. So, I mean, just with the debt ceiling and that kind of stuff, all the Republicans had to do was not increase the debt ceiling. And then the government could not have borrowed more money. Duh. But instead, they did all kinds of stupid, oh, we're going to have a super deficit hawk committee and blah, blah, blah. And they're going to give us all these recommendations. And then if they don't do it, then there's going to be these things. And then when those awful ramifications from their own super deficit hawk committee kicked in, the Republicans went along with the Democrats and to, you know, strip away a lot of those penalties. So anyway. So Nathan, to answer your question, yeah, they might run on that and they might even get elected big on that. And then they're not gonna do it, is my guess. I mean, just the absurdity of it. Who is the I realize I'm getting a little bit worked up here with you guys. But I really want people to realize this: the Republican Party is not at all the party of a free market, smaller government, and that kind of stuff. I mean, the reason I'm so angry about it is that I used to believe that, and I feel betrayed. Okay, when I was younger, you know, I came of age in the very late 1980s, and especially in the early 90s, when I really got into politics and stuff. You know, I would get the newspaper and go to the op-ed pages and read that, and I subscribed to National Review, you know, all that jazz. Listen to Rush Limbaugh, and the excuse all along for why Ronald Reagan had to increase spending so much, and that's why we had such a big deficit in the 80s. The excuse was always, well, because the Democrats controlled Congress, and so Reagan had no choice to get through his awesome tax cuts and to build up the military to beat the Soviet Empire, which he did. Thank goodness we had Ronnie in there. That he had no choice. He would have loved to cut spending 10%. He would have loved to, but he couldn't because of Tip O'Neill and all those dirty liberal Democrats and Ted Kennedy. And so Reagan had to compromise. But okay, fine. And then when Gingrich came in, all those guys came with the contract with America. Oh, I was all fired up. Oh my gosh, I can't believe this. I've never seen the Republicans take over. This is awesome. And then what was the excuse for why government continued to grow? Well, what do you expect? We got Clinton in the White House. They can't force him to sign something. Okay. Then finally, under the Bush administration, they controlled everything. And what did we get? And you can't even blame it on, well, give me a break, Bob, 9/11. And national security was more important than balancing the budget. No, even non-defense spending went way up. They even did the prescription drug benefits thing, right? So I have long since stopped believing Republicans at the national level, certainly, when they tell me how much they're really fighting for fiscal conservatism. And it's those dirty damn Democrats and political reality that are stopping them. They're lying. They don't care. Even Paul Ryan's crazy nut job budget didn't balance the budget until something like in the 2040s. Okay, I don't remember the exact number, but I think it was at least until the 2040s. Right, let me say again. Paul Ryan's budget, Paul Ryan's the darling of the conservative fiscal hawks. The budget he proposed, knowing full well it wasn't going to get passed. It wasn't like he built in a bunch of compromises to make it politically plausible. They knew full well that thing had no chance of getting enacted. So his budget that he proposed, saying this is a vision for what we stand for, ran deficit after deficit for decades. So even on paper, he couldn't propose a balanced budget until something like the year 2043 or something like that. I believe. I might be way out, but for sure, it was not for a long time. All right, so that's all I'm. And then I pointed that out to some people who I knew really liked Paul Ryan, and their answer is they always say, well, come on, he's already getting hammered for this thing, Bob. You got to look at political realities. And so, well, okay, I'm going to get all fired up about the guy who's going to be socialism minus 1%. Great. So anyway, to answer your question, Nathan, they may run on it, and they might even get elected on it, but that doesn't mean they're going to repeal it. Okay. Vitor asks, okay, we got just a few more. Okay, some Bitcoin questions, then we'll stop. So do you think if everyone started using Bitcoin, the U.S. would have to start balancing budgets? I don't think so, just because I guess if you're saying, are you saying, Peter, that if everyone started using it, then the government would have to switch to use Bitcoins and they wouldn't be able to use the dollar anymore? Is that where you're coming from? Okay. And so then presumably what's further behind your question is that, oh, now we wouldn't have the central bank anymore. The Fed wouldn't be there to sop up the government debt. Okay. Yeah, all right, that's a decent question. I mean, so, that was not supposed to be a backhanded compliment. I'm just trying to understand where you're coming from. Okay, so Peter's saying, what if everybody starts using Bitcoin and so it really is untenable? I mean, the IRS could run around telling people, you owe us your taxes in terms of dollar bills, but if everyone's using Bitcoin, let's just say that becomes untenable. And so just out of practical necessity, the IRS and everybody switches over to denying stuff in Bitcoin. And then if the government takes in a certain amount of revenue and then wants to spend more than that, they would have to actually get people with Bitcoin to voluntarily give it over to them, because they couldn't just do what they do now, is rely on a central bank, the Federal Reserve, in the case of the U.S., to create more dollars out of thin air to then buy the bonds from people in the private sector. And so without the Fed waiting in the background to be able to sop that stuff up, because by definition, well, not by definition, but by mathematics, you can't create more Bitcoin. Then what would that do? Well, yeah, that's pretty interesting, Peter. I guess what I would say is, so the safe answer is no, it wouldn't literally make it impossible to run a deficit because they could just legitimately borrow the money, legitimately paying it back with tax revenue, borrow money from people in the private sector. Okay, so you know, even on the classical gold standard, governments could still run deficits. And in fact, during wartime, they would run big deficits. But then they would have to pay it down. Okay, so just like a private business, right? Private businesses, even with fiat money, can't run a printing press. But yet, if you're a household, you can go into debt. And if you're a firm, you can issue bonds. So it's the same thing for the government. But certainly, it would put a much harder cap on how much they could and how deep in the debt it could go. And then, yeah, so if they went into debt for some kind of emergency during the good years, they would want to pay that thing down to give themselves some more breathing room. Whereas right now, they face no such pressure. Okay. And then, Vitor, if you just Google Robert Murphy, the economics of Bitcoin, you can see my big picture summary of it. Let me just say this. I don't know whether it's going to be used as money 30 years from now. I really don't know. What I would say, though, is I've seen a lot of people arguing that that's empirically impossible, relying on arguments drawn from Mises' monetary theory, in particular the regression theorem. And there, I'm nervous that they're setting themselves up to discredit Mises. Okay. If you go to my blog, I'll give you a thing to Google because people might be hearing this months later. If you Google Robert Murphy, if Bitcoin is a bubble, is all money always in a bubble? You'll find the blog post. All right, and so there, what I was there, and then it has links to other things I've done. And so what I've been doing with this stuff, Peter, is not taking a position one way or the other on is. So first of all, Bitcoin is not money in my mind right now. I would say though that it's a medium of exchange because I know people personally who, if they can, do commercial transactions with other people using Bitcoin. So they're not doing it just as an investment. It's not like they got into Bitcoin because they think it's going to go up in value and they want to turn a profit. They want to eventually transition so that they do more and more of their transactions in Bitcoin with other people who also think the same way they do. Okay, so it is clearly a medium of exchange by any reasonable definition of that term. And so when I see some people arguing using Mises to say Bitcoin can never be money because it was never the normal commodity, that makes me get nervous since really the linchpin of that argument was to say to go from being a mere commodity to being a medium of exchange. But Bitcoin's already done that. Bitcoin already is, in my mind, a medium of exchange. And so whether it turns into a full-blown money is just a matter of are enough people going to start copying this trend or is it going to fizzle? And to me, the regression theorem per se doesn't address that. The regression theorem, if anything, would have said it can't get off the ground, period. And yet it has gotten off the ground. So anyway, that's my view. I don't use Bitcoin, right? It's not like I'm a big booster of it and I use it. I hope everyone knows. I don't even use it. I have never owned anything of Bitcoin. But that's my stance. Okay, let's stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in.